Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Simmel, joined this week by Jason Wingrove. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, Mike. How are you?
Good, good. Excellent. And David Chapinis.
Hey, how you guys doing?
You're being smoked out, I understand.
Yeah, you know, luckily I'm not on fire, but most of LA seems to be. So, you know, best wishes to everyone who's affected by that, because it's affecting a whole lot of people.
Yeah, we have bushfires in Australia too, so we're very aware of the horrendous nature of the bushfires that you're having. So, yeah, thoughts go to everyone involved there. This week, we are going to be looking at Jurassic Park. Yes, this podcast was 65 million years in the making. Before we do that, though, I just wanted to do a shout-out or a thank you, heartfelt thank you, to Christian Martin, who is the producer of the VFX show and has now moving on. She'll actually still be coming back, hopefully, as a guest host. But she did a great job with lifting the whole game here at the VFX show, and it's, you know, obviously nothing is permanent and forever, and we wish her all the best and thank her so much for the contribution she's made over what has been now, I think, several years. So
really
appreciate that. And we appreciate you guys staying with us. We've got quite a lot of comments and stuff coming in. We don't, you know, normally discuss comments that that we get, but I would like to say that we got some really good comments from guys off the D9 team. They actually made the film, contacted me and said that they really appreciated the rundown. And you know, I just really like the fact that you guys have stuck with us, and the show has been growing over the last few years, and we really thank you so much for that, and the team behind the scenes that help put the show together each week. So as I said, 665 million years in the making, Jurassic Park, a pivotal film in many respects. I'm not going to spend a lot of time discussing the plot or the story or anything about it, because I'm pretty stunned, but I guess I should just do a reality check. Does anyone here not like this film? Is there, just speak up if you find this to be somehow, I don't know, cliched, annoying problem?
Dead silence here.
Dead silence. Crickets. Okay.
Insert sounds of crickets here.
Yeah.
Come on, Dave.
I mean,
come on.
Even me, Mr. Hard Sell, I love this movie. I absolutely love this movie.
Let's place it contextually for a second before we go on. And I thought one of the ways to do that is rather than just talk about what was happening socioeconomically or politically at the time, there are
in
many
the
references.
Period.
Sorry?
Oh, sorry, you mean.
Well, you know, sometimes you refer to the, you know, what it was like when the film came out in terms of what was going on in society around it.
Right,
what
not I found the Jurassic period, I see. Okay.
It's all right. Feel free to interrupt. What I thought we'd be interested to do is just place this film in terms of the computer technology that was mentioned in the film. So I don't know if you guys noticed or not, but I was trying to write down all the references I could to the film's computers. And that was pretty interesting. I hope I'm right in saying this. I'm fairly sure there was an early reference to the Thinking Machines machine, which was the Thinking Machine and supercomputer, which Carl Sims worked on, who was behind the Sapphire plugins. I believe also they were referring to, well, they were using Indigo computers. I noticed that when the clock was activated for him to make the dash to get out, it was a Mac.
It's all very early, like System 7 and System 6, and
you know, Mac stuff that came
up. Little QuickTime windows and things, even back then.
And then there was one other reference that I'm just looking for in my notes that was really caught me off guard. Let me see if I can find it. Did you find any of the computer stuff dated it for you? Because that was like the thing for me that just really placed it, I guess, in a time and in a period.
Yeah, that really placed it. And you know, there's the fly demo, you know, that we all played with, that and that tank game that everyone played on SGIs back in the day.
I found it. Sorry, I'm just going to interrupt you. My one reference that I missed, that I think he actually says, if you can find someone that can write a million lines of code and something about that, hook eight connection machines up together, then for the money that I bid for this project, sorry to interrupt you, but those were just my, I was like, ooh, computer memory lane. I know what he's talking about. No one else under the age of 30 would have any idea what he's
anything
talking
now
about.
With a monitor, with a tube, you know, a CRT, just totally dates. We just happened to flick past on Fox When Harry Met Sally, and it's just amazing how being someone's typing on a, you know, a computer that has a CRT on it, and I'm sure they're still everywhere in offices, but man, it just immediately just, whoa.
Especially the
time tunnel. No cord. All the phones had cords, and you know, it was just
people hell had landlines.
Yeah, that was the thing, you know. That's the, like, kind of the biggest, I think, thing now is the fact that everyone would be carrying a cell phone, And be able to say, you know, don't come out here. There's dinosaurs.
Yeah,
that's right.
We fell over the wall. There's a dinosaur.
The phones are up and running again. Call and get the damn helicopters. But I interrupted you before, David, when you were about to go on to something, because I was so enthusiastic about my connection machine reference.
My favorite piece of like technology that kind of places it, which is so ironic because of how cutting edge, of course, even. You know, the computer graphics in the film, I'm sure we're going to spend the next 45 minutes talking about. But when they talk about, you know, virtual reality, and they have the guy wearing the two Nintendo Power Gloves and the sneeze guard face mask.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
And there's like a 9-polygon DNA molecule on the screen that's like turning. And of course, the fact that the animation that's explaining how they built the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park is all, you know, really well done, but it's still 2D, you know, hand-drawn animation.
Actually, that's interesting you bring that up, because I actually think that was a valid creative choice, because for me that reminded me of Sunday Nights and the Wonderful World of Disney.
Yeah, right.
And I thought that was actually a stylistic reference. It was deliberately made to look like a child Disney instructional video from a period before even the film was made. So I know what you're saying, it looked dated, but by the same token, I thought it actually sort of meant to look like it was one of those retro training videos, you know, Mr. DNA. I thought was, and I actually thought that held up better than if they tried to do it with some kind of computer graphics. I loved that scene actually, because it's the most blatant piece of exposition in the history of Spielberg filmmaking.
Well, it's a good way to do it, you know, make it like this is essentially going to be when it opens, this is going to be a ride. So, make it like that sort of crowd control kind of sectioned off. Crowd rotating in, you know, push people through in blocks kind of thing with the whole rotating, you know, the rotating sort of chairs.
Thing,
and having it explain, what a great way to do it. Have Mr. DNA. It's perfectly justified within the script. It's, it's brilliant.
Well, now, when the film was in pre and it was in the testing phase, and we'll obviously discuss this at great length, there was a point where a test was shown that was very pivotal in computer graphics and in the filmmaking process generally, but specifically for this film, when they decided to flip the switch and move from claymation or go motion type dinosaurs over to computer graphics ones. At that time, apparently Steven Spielberg said out loud, he thought he was watching his future right up there on the screen. And to a certain extent, I think that's true of many of us. And this is also the famous line that Phil Tippett said right after, which is, I think I'm extinct, which actually made it into the film. But I wanted to just touch on this sort of turning point aspect of the film, because in a very real sense, this was the point, I think, at which ILM moved into the digital powerhouse era. It was always a special effects powerhouse, but this was the point at which they flipped the switch into being just the killer digital place. Would you agree with that, David?
I will agree with that, but I'll go one step further, and I'll say that this is, to the modern era, the most of the modern era of visual effects, the most important film made by far. You know, there was some groundbreaking stuff that had come before. You know, you have young Sherlock Holmes, you have Wrath of Khan, you have The Abyss,
T2.
And Terminator 2.
Yeah.
But while, you know, the water tentacle in The Abyss was incredibly realistic looking and holds up to this day, and the T-1000 was incredibly realistic. It was still a chrome guy. This is flesh and blood things. This is something that people would look at and they know what it's supposed to look like. It's supposed to look like the drawings that they've seen in every single dinosaur book, every single plastic dinosaur toy, and they did. And I remember vividly the reactions of people of just being blown away. Like, they could not wrap their brains over how this was done, how realistic everything in this film looked, and it was just mind-blowing. And it set off a whole new industry of saying, whatever you want to put on the screen, we can do. Give us the money, give us the time, but we can do it.
Now, now, when you say that, let me just clarify. Do you mean visual effects or do you mean special and visual effects? Because I don't think it was as pivotal as Star Wars in terms of the overall craft, but in terms of, I think it was like the birthplace of visual effects as opposed to special effects. It was the point at which that switch kind of flipped.
Well, this was the point where if you want to have a creature on screen that looked realistic, it didn't involve Jim Henson or Frank Oz, that it was no longer had to be restrained by having a puppet. You know, it's you could put whatever you want to imagine on screen. And if you kind of notice, you know, before this, every time someone had a creature on screen, it was probably the biggest creature on screen that was like a practical creature that really looked realistic was Jabba the Hutt, would probably be my guess. You know, off the top of my head that I could think of. But after this, you have, you know, Dragonheart. You have everything, you know, all the flying creatures in Lord of the Rings. You have, you know, all that kind of stuff where people were not limited any longer by a suit somebody can fit in or a puppet somebody had to work. And that it opened up a whole new realm of digital creatures, digital characters that could be put on the screen. And it just enabled a whole new set of stories that you could tell. This film changed my career. I mean, I'd wanted to be a model maker up until the point Jurassic Park came out. Specifically, I wanted to be the guy that would blow up and set fire to the models. But
I always liked Tron. I always was into computers. But anyway,
I was into computers. But like when Jurassic Park came out, I realized that. You know, the days of models and the days of all that kind of stuff were going to be over by the time I became an adult. So
just placing this film on a timeline, we were in fact, you mentioned Dragonheart there. I think that came out in 96. Jurassic was out in 93. It was in fact in post, I guess, when T2 came out, or was it T2 already come out by the time this film, but it was right on the heels of T2. T2 was definitely the kind of enabler that gave ILM, I think, the kind of the spurt of everything that it needed. But I think it's astonishing, and you've even tweeted this, or no, you don't think you sent it in an email I read, David, that the number of visual effect shots in this film, if you were to ask me point blank how many visual effect shots there were, like digital dinosaurs in this film, I'd have easily said, I don't know, 300-400. It wouldn't have been, you know, today it would be 2,000, but maybe 200-300. David, you want to tell us how many actual digital visual effects dinosaur shots there were in this?
I don't know the exact number, but because I was watching the behind-the-scenes documentary in preparation for today, and they said with a lot of pride that there were over 50 visual effects or computer-generated effects shots in the movie.
Yep, 50.
And I believe in that email I said that I believe in Transformers 2 there is – over 50 digital animation shots even before the credits finished rolling, the opening credits. So, you know, they were used and used very, very, very well.
Yeah, if you actually bother to look at the film, you know, there's a lot of other stuff. There's a lot of the pre-stuff in the desert. There's a lot of, you know, the exposition with, you know, Mr. DNA. You know, there's a lot of getting to the dinosaurs, which is fantastic. It's all building up tension. T2 was 91.
Well, there's also a bit of tension in the way of Jaws, in that we didn't see the dinos. I mean, we had that great reveal when they first get to the island, and I actually think Sam Neill's performance with pulling the sunglasses off and looking just gobsmacked really helped carry that. But there's no doubt about it, my favorite scene in the entire film is looking down at those two, is it brachiosauruses coming out of the water, and the other guys are down drinking at the lake edge. I mean, that was majestic, magnificent, epic. And but nevertheless, after that, we did go into a period where we weren't seeing them, and especially we weren't seeing the T-Rex. And I think that built up the tension in much the same way as that not seeing the shark in Jaws did a good thing. So I think it worked for the film. Not only did it sort of save ILM from dying, but you know, only doing 50... Well, because, you know, how could they have done... on an Indigo 2, I mean, doing 50 shots was astonishing.
Right, yes, just have not so much...
It reminds me of when, you know, another visual effects film that came out in that same era, I believe it was 95, The Frighteners came out. I was watching the wonderful fly in the wall documentary that they is on the HD DVD.
Isn't that great? Terrific?
It's absolutely fantastic. But it's hilarious because the behind the scenes was meant to come out on a, you know, they keep referring it to as the laser disc, you know, so it's meant to come out with the movie in 95, 96. So they talk with, you know, great pride how some of their digital composites have three, even four layers to their composite, you know, and it's just, it's amazing when you look back the fact that, you know, it's hard to fathom the fact that Jurassic Park is older than probably some of our listeners. You know, that it's 17 years old when yep. this movie went into effect. And it's what I find really, really stunning is the fact that you look at Jurassic Park now, which I, you know, I watched it on DVD yesterday for preparation for today. It's been on cable a lot recently. And the effects, by and large, still hold up way better than a lot of the digital effects that even came afterwards. Definitely. And, you know, it was also, I think, very bold because they went into this. Yeah, they did the test where they had the skeleton running. But to say, we're going to do this and we're going to have to invent a whole lot of stuff that we don't even know what we're going to have to invent yet. And to have that bravery to have, you know, Spielberg film an empty field and trust in his visual effects artists that they'd be able to do it is just mind-boggling, you know?
Yeah, and then, well, then knew they had this breakthrough technology, but then also they went pushing it. And no, I'm not going to lock down the camera. Let's put it on a wonky sort of steady cam or bungee rig on the middle of a field and drive the four-wheel drive through the middle of the field. Very, very little tracking markers and just, you know, have people do their eyelines all
okay,
over the place.
Okay, that shot with them running with the...
Yeah, with the Gallimimus herd.
That was an amazing piece of hand tracking.
Yeah.
That the only other film that really impressed me around that time for that kind of hand tracking was Twister, which was, again, I think still done pre-digital tracking. But
right.
I guess it helped that the feet of the animals were not standing on the ground for long. So if there was a tiny amount of drift, you know, because they were just like running, but still.
Yeah, and they're en masse and you never quite.
Can you imagine
sort of...
being at the pre-production meeting? We should back up and say who was at that meeting. But the pre-production meeting where somebody said, hey, I've got a good idea. Let's run the camera along a handheld and have these beasts, which up until... what, months ago we thought we couldn't do.
Couldn't even create them. And now
digitally placed in a moving camera. I mean, oh my gosh.
If I was in a meeting these days, now, whatever, 16, 70 years later and say, oh, I want this CG animal. Oh, but I really don't want to lock the camera down. They go, you know, can we just not? It's going to
be
really...
not in my meeting, but...
No, sure. But even but today, people, you know, are afraid of moving the camera. And back then they hadn't even really... They didn't even know what they were doing and they still went ahead and just, you know, moved. I mean, obviously it helps if you're Spielberg and you just say, I'm going to move the freaking camera and too bad and you just work with it. Let me
paint a mental picture of that pre-production meeting because the four principal visual effects artists that were at work here. Now, Michael Innertine was the guy who was responsible for the interaction between the actors on set and anything that happened. Like he would make the tree move when the dino wasn't there. He would make
right.
the car and the other three were Dennis Muren, was obviously from ILM, who started out as the guy who was going to be combining all the stuff onto film and doing the post. Though, of course, as we have just discussed, they quickly got elevated to doing the fully moving, sort of full-scale moving dinosaurs. The live-action dinosaurs, in other words, the dinosaur head that might be interacting with an actor, but it's actually a giant kind of... puppet, to want to use a better term, was going to be coming from Stan Winston and his team. And then the dino supervisor that was doing the go motion was going to be Phil Tippett. And Phil's miniatures work or go motion work was the work that moved over to ILM. And I think what was really interesting go on.
It's not, I mean, yeah, that's on the visual effects, like the supervisory level. Plus you have, you know, brilliant production design in the term of you know, Rick Carter. You have and the actual crew that was there at ILM. You're talking about like an all-star team. You know, you're talking like 2004 Boston Red Sox here. You know, you had Steve Williams. You know, Steve Spaz Williams. I think I'm legally required to say. You had Mark Dipp. You had, you know, just as listed as CGI artists are, you know, Joe Letteri and Steve Rosenbaum, who are now two of the most yep. respected visual effects supervisors working in our industry. And they were just simple, you know, crew guys on the film. I mean, this is like an all-star cast. So,
absolutely. You're absolutely right to mention that because, I mean, yeah, couldn't have been more of a team effort, and there was such depth in each of these areas. Of course, we've lost some of these people now with the ravages of time, and it's a shame to not have some of these people still with us in the industry today. But I do think what was interesting is that, and what I was sort of heading to was that when the move happened with the stuff going from Phil Tippett's team over to Dennis Muren's ILM team, a lot of the animators that were going to be on the stop motion were sent in to kind of advise and help ILM, and it just was slightly incongruous in the making of DVD when they were discussing this, like ILM would need help with animation. Do you know what I mean? It's like I had to remind myself there would be once upon a time when someone outside ILM would know a heck of a lot more about how to move a character than ILM's own team. And I think it was great that Phil Tippett was so instrumental in sort of directing and supervising the dinosaurs, because it'd be a shame to have lost that. But
did a lot of his animation then end up become essentially the animatic, the sort of moving boards?
I think he separately had decided to previs the project by doing a claymation, sort of basically a three-dimensional storyboard.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that was that the footage was going to be in the film and then...
That's
what's really interesting also is, you know, they did the very simple, you know, pencil cam animatic for Return of the Jedi for the speeder bike chase. But this is the first film that I know of where they did go into like a full motion pre-visualization rather than just pure storyboards or an animatic storyboard, you know, where you're stealing bits of other movies. But to, you know, now it's a major business and it's a big thing to be doing pre-vis. But
yeah.
I can't think of a film that I know of where they did such elaborate pre-visualization of the effects before this. But the getting Phil Tippett's team on, that did start one really ugly trend in computer graphics, which I think finally died out around like 2000, 2002, was the idea of what they called it, the dinosaur input device. There's like a commercial version called the Monkey that was, you know, supposed to be this like, oh, you can animate a lot quicker if you just have this figure to pose. And it was, you know, you had to get it so it worked with the software. And it was way I was once asked to hook one up and I was like, no, here's a mouse, set keyframes.
Well, not only that, but one of the problems with that, just taking it to the next level, apart from the sort of connecting it up issue, is it's very, very hard with that, which is pivoted at the waist, that sort of monkey device, to get any sense of actual weight in the performance because their legs are dangling. And so you don't tend to animate so as to give a character weight. And I thought one of the things that succeeded extremely well in this film was the T-Rex running sequence and how much physicality and weight it had in its kind of movement. Because it was running, what, 30, 40 miles an hour, and yet it was enormous, and yet it still felt like it was big, solid. It felt like a giant sort of linebacker running, not some kind of, you know, because the run cycles, it's nothing trivial to scale that between a tiny creature that's dashing around and a giant creature such as the T-Rex. And that run cycle, interestingly, flagged something else for me when I was watching the making of. They were discussing the fact that the animator would often watch that running backwards. And I'm wondering, David, I'm not a character animator. Is that something that character animators still do? I mean, I thought it was an interesting
point. Absolutely. It's kind of like when you know, any kind of like a 2D artist will take an image and they'll flip it upside down or flip it left to right in order to get away from the emotional attachment that you have to it, so you can look at it a lot more analytically. And when you're watching it backwards, you tend to pick up. Like if when you watch something forwards, your brain kind of automatically fixes the mistakes and overlooks the things that you as an animator know should be there. And especially like if you're planning on doing the shot, that you kind of automatically connect from A to C by putting in B when it might not even be there. But by watching it backwards, it's a lot more conscious. It's kind of like for a drunk driving test where they ask you to say the alphabet backwards or say the alphabet without singing the song.
Right.
You know, it makes you consciously notice and think about the animation. It's a very, very, very common technique.
Another thing that was interesting is watching basically a crowd herding type situation with the Gallimine flock, and that the flocking wasn't done through Massive, wasn't done through flocking software, but was actually done by, I think they just the term they used was moving hood ornaments around.
It looked like they just drew little tracks in the know, on the ground plane, and basically they could just, yeah, they all had their own little track. It was, I think they looked like they were just animating the flock avoidance sort
directorially
of thing.
From your point of view, let's combine those two things. I love the T-Rex and thus the T-Rex attack that happens at the end of the flocking sequence, and the Gallimine herding stuff, as a, you know, with your director's hat on, how did you feel that played out? Because it was, for me, a really strong scene in the film.
Oh, when I think of Jurassic Park, the scene that leaps out at me is the very first, you know, the first scene.
The one with the Brachiosaurus, or the one with the herds of the Gallimines?
When the Brachiosaur is, it's reaching for the upper branches, right, and then it's resting down, and there's a little bit of camera bounce, and John Williams' score swells, and Sir Richard Attenborough says, "Welcome to Jurassic Park," and you see all the different, you know, breeds of dinosaurs drinking from the lake, and John Williams' score just sort of gets you in the guts, and it's just a combination of fantastic, you know, Steve's using the camera to almost as another element to push the emotion, some, you know, okay acting from Sam Neill.
You like Sam Neill's acting?
Oh, he doesn't strike me as the brilliant actor, actor in the world. He's actually being helped by the dinosaurs.
Yeah,
CGI dinosaurs so good, you'll believe Sam Neill can act.
Well, you have to remember the other thing is this is probably one of the earliest instances of, you know, actors having to act to an empty field. You know, or you know, Dennis Muren running around with a dinosaur head on a stick, you know, so
drawing of a dinosaur head on a
exactly.
stick.
Exactly. So I
must admit, I actually thought their performances when that Jeep first pulls up.
Yeah.
I want to get back to the
no
attack sequence, but yeah, I thought it was kind of good.
Yeah, I guess I've got a long running Sam Neill kind of.
No, that's probably
not dislike. I just, he never sort of
really strikes
me. Well, he stiffed
you for the bill in that restaurant that time.
What I find is fantastic about that, and I guess from doing research and looking at the making of Jurassic Park, well thumbed and dog-eared
book, isn't it? Yeah.
They shot all of the stuff in Kauai in 3 weeks, and in the middle of that, they had a cyclone that destroyed half of their sets. While they're doing that, Spielberg is prepping to go off and do Schindler's List.
Oh,
He's in the middle of he's posting Jurassic Park, you know, via very early, you know, internet
kind of stuff. Yeah.
While he's at night, while he's shooting, you know, Schindler's List, and both those films were done on time, on schedule, and both completely different mindsets.
Well, in fact, they wrapped on principal photography on Jurassic 12 days ahead of schedule.
Yeah, ahead of schedule with a cyclone in the middle of it. And there is so much footage, you know, with dinosaurs that if they got, you're shooting with them in the rain, and if they got wet, then they started to get the shakes. And people had to whack them with cloths to dry them off. And you've got all that sort of stuff. You're shooting at night, you're shooting with children, you're shooting with technology that's never been invented yet.
Yeah.
He's on pre for another film. He goes off and posts this film while he finishes the other one. And both of those films are absolutely outstanding. And both of them are completely different mindset. That's for me, is utterly. This is Spielberg's finest hour, I reckon.
Huh.
To do both of those and to do shoot one during the day and post another, switch hats like that mentally, you know, I just would find astounding. And to have them both come out so brilliantly and so completely different, I guess it does my head in.
I guess where I was going with asking you about the directing, and I'm going to ask David because you refused to answer my question, is I thought the scene where the T-Rex comes out of the bushes from the side and just obviously devours...
The night car attack on the street.
No, I'm going to get to that next. That was the second scene.
Oh, this is that the objects may appear larger than they actually are.
Okay, I'm just going to give up on my... No, I'm talking about the herd being attacked by the T-Rex. I'm just going to give up
that.
Obviously, nobody else likes that.
Right, yeah.
Let's move on to the T-Rex attacking the car, because clearly this is what we want to talk about.
On the herd jumping over there's one moment in that I think, you know, they thought to do it on set, which is they wiggle the tree, you know, as the Gallimimuses or Gallimimi or... The dinosaurs, as they leaped over, someone thought to physically, you know, manipulate the real tree, and it adds so much to that scene. And, you know, this is also one of those cases where, you know, not being able to do everything you want with effects, or at least having a little bit of restraint. You know, they had two shots of the dinosaur, of the T-Rex eating the Gallimimus. You know, today I'm sure they would have gone in for like a nice tight close-up and, you know, blood, digital blood hitting the lens or whatever. But, you know, it was a nice restrained view of it. It was very much like a, you know, BBC documentary on, you know, and now we see the T-Rex eating his dinner. You know, it was very much like a nature film. It was very cool.
Yeah, which helped kept it real.
Well, that's what Spielberg wanted, right? Yeah. Spielberg wanted them to be animals, not monsters, which I think is a really pivotal point that you've hit there.
But did you see, I think, remember, and Mike, if you've recently watched that fabulous making of, a lot of that previous for the Gallimimus herd was all of the ILM guys running in the car park and jumping over logs and things. So they probably would have got the idea for knocking that, you know, knocking the log. Because if you look at the, you know, that those test shots, they're all jumping over and people are physically tripping, you know, obviously intentionally, but tripping over the log and, you know, basically being a herd of people all in each other's way. So it probably, you know, it came out of, that was the joy, probably one of the great things of doing, taking the time to do all that previs. How do the herd avoid each other? Because as you say, they couldn't do it in the software. The software couldn't do all that, what do you call it?
Avoidance.
Software starts thinking for itself.
Yeah, avoidance.
Well,
fuzzy logic.
AI stuff that you get from
AI, fuzzy logic kind of thing. Exactly. Where, so that they literally filmed it and that was your animatic. So, yeah, I guess that the little gags like that on set probably come from doing a bit of planning. Failure requires little planning.
Well, I mean, to take that idea of bumping the log further, the car attack is really a case of having a CG character interacting. Though I had forgotten, if I ever knew, that in some of those scenes with the car being attacked in the rain by the T-Rex, the car is actually digital. I'd always assumed that the car had been a mechanical device.
Right, really, yeah, because there's interesting shots there where the T-Rex smashes the side of the car with his head, and there's not a dent, and then he smacks it with his head, and then there is a dent. So I guess, it sounds like that's the kind of thing they could put that in later. That just sounds like that's,
in looking
that's
at it today,
going beyond. Wow,
the T-Rex attacking the car did feel a little long for me, but at the time, it wasn't. At the time, I thought it was really,
still,
really good.
But there's a
still
lot
not
of,
too long for me. That's
No, it's fabulous. There's a lot of stuff in there that is not CGI dinosaurs. You know, Dr.
Malcolm.
What's his name? Dr. Malcolm. Knocking the gear stick and getting it out of drive, and then, you know, there's a lot of other footage in there that's tension building that doesn't rely on CGI dinosaurs. It's just outstanding. It's the slowest freaking Jeep in the world, but I think it's just fantastic. And full marks for, again, going for with technology they did not know how to do it, to put the dinosaur in dappled moonlight and rain and lightning and interactive lightning and shadows from the moonlight of the trees, and then put the dinosaur right in your face, literally filling the frame, and get away with it. It just blows me away.
And you were saying with the tension building, like the two of the tensest shots in that move, in that sequence, aren't at all you know, the CGI dinosaurs. It's the vibrating water glass and the, you know, where it's a shot of the windshield all fogged up, and then Dr. Malcolm like wipes it so he can see what's going on. You know, I think that's like two of the most effective shots in that sequence. By the way, little piece of trivia: the concentric rings in the footprint that Dr. Malcolm sees later on is the concentric rings that are used in the DreamWorks logo when the little Bob hits the water.
Good bit of trivia.
That was reused today. Yeah,
right. His fishing float when it hits the water.
Okay. Repurposed.
Right.
Nice one, Centurion.
Very nice.
I've got to say,
that sequence, the car, the T-Rex car attack sequence, I think we can call it, is, I think, one of the most effective scenes in the entire movie. Overall, like, of all films ever, and it's still one of the most impressive bits of computer animation and compositing ever. I mean, you can't tell when it cuts.
No.
Like, the only time you can tell when it cuts from the CGI to the robots is the robots don't move as well as the CG. But that's it. Yeah. It's fantastic.
And tension with a little bit of humor at the end. Do you think they'll have that on the ride?
one of the things I liked when I went back to look at it was some of the stuff that wasn't the CG dinosaurs. Because I remember it that way. When the dinosaur, the T-Rex, attacks the lawyer in the loo, in the bathroom, in the restroom, for the Americans that are listening, that was a case of substituting for a digital, effectively a ragdoll animation as he gets bitten and lifted up. And I think that there's a couple of those things, and the face replacement that happens later when the raptors are trying to jump up into the ceiling.
Yeah, the girl falls through the roof grill.
I remember to this day, yes, sitting in the cinema with my wife beside me.
Yep.
And as that happened, she turned from the screen and turned from the screen and screamed
at
thus
you.
In my ear. And we saw it a second time. I don't know, we went with somebody else, and she did exactly the same thing. And I said, how could you scream twice? You already knew what was going to happen. And she said, I closed my eyes the first time, I never saw it.
How fantastic, and how fantastically subtle and fleeting is that little bit of face replacement.
But this is a sequence, I guess,
it's not in the kitchen, is it? I can't remember. They're hiding in the roof from the raptors. And the girl climbs up the ladder,
and the ladder gets knocked over.
Right.
Because I thought that face replacements really came into their own around the time of Titanic, actually, for stunt face replacements. I wasn't even aware this was in the film.
And it is faultlessly done. It is so quick and so fleeting, the face fully tilts up and fully tilts down. It's beautifully timed. There's nothing out of whack. It's so quick,
face replacement works really well, but they also need to do an arm replacement because girl's got some guts. Like
the stunt woman playing Lex is quite buff.
Yeah, it was like, welcome to the gun show. It was...
you can tell. Actually, when you look at the shot of the Gallimimus herd, when you first see the Gallimimus herd sort of sweeping through, and there's a shot of the back, there's all three of them on the grass from the back looking at them. You can definitely tell the girl is that's the buff stunty, and not the real one.
No,
she doesn't look quite right. She holds herself differently. But hey, we're being too picky. That is an astounding piece of little subtle. I love those little sort of bits.
My only fault with the film actually is not anything to do with that. My only fault with it is when he starts talking about chaos theory and nonlinear equations. And as I actually have a degree in pure mathematics, I'm like, I'm sorry, but a nonlinear equation could be like x squared plus x plus 1 equals 0. I don't think that's actually going to get you to a PhD in chaos theory. But anyway.
I loved it. His character was fantastic in the dialogue. He's so, not slimy.
I bring you scientists, you bring me rock stars.
It's brilliant.
But it was actually a bit of a turning point for that actor, because Jeff Goldblum was never that buffed before.
Right.
He was always the, I don't know, whatever that was, that film that had the 60s soundtrack.
Yeah, The Big Chill.
Big Chill, yeah, he was the sort of dweeby, dorky guy.
Funnily enough, you see in The Big Chill, he's doing that sort of handy, maybe it's his thing.
Yeah.
He's doing the sort of, he's playing handies with Laura Dern in the helicopter, and he's doing exactly the same. It's almost like they lifted it from The Big Chill. If you look at The Big Chill again, there's quite a lot of
And just we're
his
on a rat hole, you realize
there.
That Spielberg was directing the guy that beat him for the Oscar because Richard Attenborough won
right.
for Gandhi against
right. E.T. Right. Oh, again, Richard Attenborough's character in this film is just so wonderful, and you so buy it.
I think Richard Attenborough is just marvelous.
Just outstanding. That line, welcome to Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
So proud of it. The fool.
Because it is a theme park, right? You need someone that's going to be a bit cheesy and want to embrace that and not kind of go running from it.
Now, can I jump back to the face placement thing? I was thinking about it. That was actually probably a fix for an accidental, probably it was a great gag. The stunt went well, except the stuntie just looked straight in, put her face right down to the lens. Any stunt person will totally... I'm sure they didn't... I'm guessing they didn't plan that.
No, they wouldn't have. I'm sure you're right.
She just flicked her look up to the lens.
Because, I remember in True Lies, he gets on the back of the horse in one of the chase sequences and rides with his head between his arms so that you can't tell that it isn't Schwarzenegger. And I'm like, come on.
Yeah, they've fallen magically.
Hands always go across the face.
Yeah. Oh, but with my last dying bit of energy, I will cover my face.
But anyway, let's get back to the visual effects because we don't want to rat hole too much.
Oh, come on. Okay. All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
So So the location, I think, gave us a lot in terms of what was going on. I think that it really, really felt like, you know, sort of tied in stuff. I think you touched on it earlier when you said the lighting. I just wanted to focus on the lighting because we sort of skipped over to that in terms of the dinos. You mentioned that because of this great location, they've got a dinosaur running at night with moonlight and everything else. But there was a lot of visual effects in bright... Exactly, David, exactly. Do you want to talk about that? Because that really at the time was the you don't want to go there sort of thing, wasn't it?
At the time, still. You know, I would way prefer people put stuff in the dark. This is just... I don't know.
But that's what's great about this film. There's no avoid. There's no. No one's trying to avoid any issues, is there? They're just going.
Well,
for
the
it.
Thing is that's what's interesting about this film is I don't know if they kind of went, pardon my French, balls out because they were like, you know what, if we're gonna do this, we're gonna do it big. You know, go big or go home. Or if they were just like, can we do this? I don't know. Let's find out. Like if it was like not ignorance because that has a bad connotation to it. And you know, I would not say that Dennis Muren is ignorant about anything.
No.
They didn't know what they couldn't do.
Exactly. That's a perfect way of saying that. You know, I'm sure later on they might go, is there any way we can maybe
we
put
that.
This at 9 o'clock at night? Fitness. It's lunchtime. Well, no, 9 o'clock at night. You can eat lunch at night. You know, they just did everything that we could. You can do. They did it. They put it in bright sunlight. They put it in. What I actually think is almost harder than bright sunlight, which is in Hawaii a lot, you get this kind of like general overcast where light is coming from everywhere. And, like that tends to make CG look really, really fake. So it's just like they just did everything and just threw it right at you and you completely and utterly bought it. Including they invented the, we're going to not have any actors at all. We're just going to have computer graphics fight computer graphics for our big finale, and you'll love it. They even did that, and it was all done perfectly because they spared no expense, you know.
To that point, can I shout out to Dean Cundey, the DP, who like needs no shout out, but you know, at that time and still is a god of, you know, doing, he sort of, like it or hate it, he was, you know, the king of doing special effects movies, Back to the Future, Hook, Casper, Roger Rabbit, Apollo 13, Romancing the Stone, The Thing, oh my god, it just goes on and on. He's just absolute, he must be wonderful to work with because he's gets repeat work with directors, work with him time and time again, and Zemeckis and all of those guys, just, you know, and he must be just brilliantly, you know, brilliant at, you know, working with CGI and MoCo rigs and, you know, you name it, working for green screen. He just must be sensational because he's done so much of it. And this film looks fantastic, still looks great.
Yeah, I think it looks good. I think that it has a nice feel in terms of the visuals because you know, the storm and the wet and the stuff really added to it, but that day night kind of thing played well in just not having it seem, you know, because sometimes you have this kind of, well, they're going somewhere and at the end they're going to have the big fight, and it didn't feel like that. There was sort of people going left, people going right, people were trying to do opposite things, and the lighting and the design of it, production design, and of course cinematography, kept me very clear as to who was where and what was going on.
But to keep it on schedule as well. I mean, so oftentimes if the schedule is
location,
if your schedule is dragging, you know, yes, the director can dick around, but you know, DPs are really good at it too. DPs and sound guys. That can really do, you know, and not from wanting to be slow, just something like the way guys work can be slow or can be quick and they can end up with the brilliantly, you know, same results. But, you know, clearly.
There's that old joke, you know, why don't DPs smoke? Because it takes them 2 hours to light anything.
Yeah, I mean, to do what he does. And
a whole new group we've insulted. Oh, great.
And sound man, let me tell you about sound man. No, to do this film, give it a great look, and keep on schedule, and all not ahead of schedule, despite, you know, changing Kauai, tropical weather.
When you kept saying keeping on schedule and actually finishing ahead of time, makes me wonder, you know, why didn't they do another take of the girl falling through the roof and not looking up, you know?
Maybe they did, and maybe someone said, wow, we can use, or maybe it was planned. I don't know. I'd love to know. If you know the story behind that shot, let us know.
Don't you think that to a certain extent back then it was a little bit more like, well, you're never going to notice? I mean, I can remember that. It was like, you're not going to notice that, right?
There might have been a second unit shot with no video split, and the operator didn't, you know, blink that moment, or, you know, who knows?
This is still the era where if a boom mic got into the shot, you had to do the shot over again. People actually had to pay attention when they were working on a film set, and
you weren't in that mindset, were you? Just, oh well, it's quicker. You weren't as used as we are now to going, let me see now, it's going to take me 20 minutes to reset this shot or 15 minutes to paint that out later, let's move on. So yeah, there wasn't that mindset.
Yeah, whichever was the first visual effects supervisor on set, that when a boom mic came into frame and said, oh, don't worry, we can fix that later, we all hate him. Like,
ah, they can fix that later.
God damn it.
There's a matte box in the middle of the shot. We just thought, you know, there was a flare. You guys can paint that out.
Okay, yeah. Though, again, rat-holing slay, but I do think that there was a lot to be said. In the early days, it was quite hostile on set when you're a supervisor. And if you could do something nice for the production, like say, I'll take that out in post, that won you the brownie point. So when later you have
Absolutely.
To stop the entire production
Absolutely.
To stick stupid little yellow dots up everywhere, that they would say, all right, okay, fair enough, because you help us out on the other shot. And I think we just traded favors. And I honestly think it was a worthwhile trade at the time, because honestly, on the early days on set, we were, why are you here? And get out of my face.
Yeah, you just need to know five words. We'll take care of that.
Yeah, and after every shot, everyone would turn back, look over at craft services and say, will that work? And the VFX soup, mouthful of cake. Oh, good, yeah, fine, great. Okay, moving on.
Oh, good. He says you can fix it.
Okay.
Should we get him to sign something?
So I think we generally agreed that the film was incredibly, important. I think also that we should frame it in terms of, from this film, we really just were on an incredible trajectory. I mean, Titanic was 97, and I don't think there's any way you could have done a Titanic without Jurassic. Like, it was this idea of, I think you said it earlier, David, of being able to pull off the impossible, and just 4 short years between the two.
Well, I think
really astounding period of growth.
I think kind of what happened is there's a lot of studios in town, a lot of executives and such, who had scripts that they had, you know, read or had bought even, and had put on a shelf going, well, it's a good story, but we just can't make this.
Don't know how to make it.
And, you know, because it's like, you know, someone read a script where, like, and the tornadoes attack the people for 90 minutes. And someone's like, okay, well, we're not, it's a good story, whatever, but we're not going to make this because we can't, you know, what are we going to do? Stick an actors out in the middle of Kansas and hope something happens? You know, that doesn't work very well, especially for the actors. But this was, you know, I think every kind of executive reached up to that shelf and pulled down the scripts that, you know, had been marked as can't be made. And, you know, maybe some of them shouldn't have been. But the, you know, it did set off a kind of whole new era of what could be done. I mean, you have soon after this, you have Starship Troopers, you have Hollow Man, you have Dragonheart, you have Casper, you have Flubber, you have, as you said, Titanic, and I think it kind of then reaches its denouement with, Gollum in Lord of the Rings. Like, that was the next big step, where you had a digital character that was acting with your actors.
I think I'd agree with you from a character animation point of view, but I do think that Titanic was almost as, not quite, but almost as influential in just showing that you could do the impossible.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I think this, yeah. But I think character animation, yes, because, of course, then you hit subsurface scattering, which is the one thing that we didn't have with these dinosaurs. We didn't have the benefit of the light play that you get from subsurface scattering, that I think was one of the big factors that made Gollum so believable.
Yeah, I think the other... I think the other kind of telling thing is also when you go and look at Jurassic Park 2 and Jurassic Park 3, that they each, you know, they seem to kind of want to one-up themselves with, like, what they could do. Like, ILM was trying to compete with itself with each of those films. I remember sitting down to see Jurassic Park 2 in the theater, and I think it's the very first time you see a CG dinosaur on screen, you see what are the ones with the fins down their back? We need a five-year-old here to tell us.
Stegosaurus.
Yeah, you know, you see that, sorry. And then, like, 2 seconds later, one passes, you know, 4 inches in front of the camera, so you see, like, every little detail of its skin. And even then, I was like, okay, ILM's just showing off now.
That was the stupid one, wasn't it, Jurassic Park 2?
I know a lot of people have problems with Jurassic Park 2. I still think that the trailer sequence in that is on par with the car destruction sequence in Jurassic Park 1. I think that's a great sequence. So
actually, that trailer park trailer over the cliff sequence was lifted almost entirely from the book, whereas a lot of the other stuff wasn't from the book. And I can tell you that because I was actually this is going to sound slightly wankish, but I was actually sailing around the Whitsundays reading Jurassic 2, the book, which is an area like Hawaii, and it has that feel. And we'd go ashore at places that didn't have any people. And as you remember, in Jurassic Park 2, the whole thing starts with people going ashore in somewhere that they shouldn't. And so I remember that book very vividly. And it was the trailer park scene. It was one of the few scenes that actually made it from Michael Crichton's book into the second one.
Right. Is that where the little girl gets attacked by all the little compies?
Yeah, that is at the beginning of that one,
Right. When they're, that's about the best bit of the film.
The kid buys it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember reading, we're going down a slight rat hole, but I remember reading the Lost World, the Lost World book. And in the book, there's these dinosaurs that are like these super chameleons that would take on the coloration of whatever is behind them. So that they would just kind of disappear. And I even remember reading this going, oh, God, Michael Crichton's discovered camera projection mapping. Like, it's just like he was designing a dinosaur that would look cool in computer graphics. Like, that was my thought when I was reading that book.
Well, I want to thank you guys for being on the show this week. And, you know, thank you very much for your time and listening to us. I want to thank our production team also, Laurie Anthop and Todd Schultner, who's been really good and been with us for a while. We have this as a joint production of Pixel Core and the FX Guide team. On the internets, are we best to refer to you by your website, Jason?
JasonWingrove.com or Wingrove on Twitter.
Yeah, you're normally Wingrove on Twitter when I see you going on about sort of new Canon cameras.
Or the other podcast that we do together,
Mike.
We're
going to get you to blog again, David. I go to your blog occasionally. It hasn't been updated since Moses thought it was a good idea to have tone.
I'm trying to find time. I'm busy writing, you know, prospective screenplays and packing up my life here in LA because I'm about to move. So I'll blog when I'm damn well ready. Until then, you can find me on Twitter as David Scrupinus.
And actually, if you want to complain about David, that is the best place to do it, just directly to him.
If you want to go to it, it's davidscrupinus.com, although I'm moving it over to Squarespace. So you can go to davidscrupinus.squarespace.com, and you can actually send a nice long email filled with hate from there, and I will get it.
No, we're only joking. And I want to just really, once again, congratulate, as we have done frighteningly too many times, the work of ILM and the team that did this film some 16 years ago, because really we all owe them a huge debt of gratitude.
I think the key to this film, like to show how important it is, you talk to just about any visual effects artist who's in their mid-30s, you know, that probably 28 to 37 age range, and they will say that this is the film that made them go into visual effects. So,
but it's probably the film that made Gary Rydstrom's work on this probably made a million people get into sound design and or scoring or DPing, or I think it's inspirational on so many levels, all of which, you know, go together to make a fantastic film. But you're absolutely right. I'm sure like a few of the films we cover in the classics on here on VFX show, they are shows that launched films that launch a fair few careers.
Well, I'm just going to finish up by saying God creates dinosaurs, God destroys dinosaurs. God creates man, man destroys God. Man creates dinosaurs eat man, men review dinosaurs. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you.